read to him the 29th scroll. 6th verse.
Beware the beast man, for he is the devil's pawn. Alone among God's primates, he kills for sport or lust or greed. Yea, he will murder his brother to possess his brother's land. Let him not breed in great numbers, for he will make a desert of his home and yours. Shun him, drive him back into his jungle lair, for he is the harbinger of death.
Welcome to the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, Planet of the Apes Retrospective Series.
My friends, I have convened this extraordinary meeting of the Council in order that I may report upon an action which I deemed necessary.
Join Matt.
You are a good and wise ape.
Garrett.
The human way is violence and death.
And Adam.
The only thing they fear more than me is you apes.
As they travel through the spectrum of Earth and into the Forbidden Zone, and consequently dissect the most primitive of all film franchises.
My God, did we finally do it?
From the Charlton Heston starring 1968 original,
take your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape!
To director Tim Burton's 2001 remake,
we've been searching for you for so long.
All the way through the latest entry, 2024's Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes.
I don't believe it!
The man will see, the man will do, their opinions of how good or inferior each movie in the series truly is.
He has a definite gift for mimicry.
All coming up, courtesy of Percolated Media.
All of human history has led to this moment.
Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Released July 11th, 2014. Budget was $170 million. Box office, $710 million. And this was directed by Matt Reeves. So we've gone from $90 million budget to nearly double, and a box office gross that did exceed the first film in this rebooted franchise. But did all that extra money translate to how we feel positivity in regards to this film? Boys, we've taken a few years off, but Fox was adamant about getting a sequel to Rise of the Planet of the Apes done as quickly as possible.
As they always are. And, you know, I gotta say, out of all the films in this retrospective, including those first few, this was the one I was most curious about. Because A, I had never seen it. B, I remember even at the time, even though I hadn't seen it, the hype about it was, not only was it one of the best apes films, it was one of the best films of the year, and one of the best science fiction films of the last decade. So, as people know, when it comes to hype, I tend to kind of cringe, and it already makes me look at it with a more critical eye. But with distance behind it, this thing's already been out 10 years, which is crazy to say, I was curious to see if, with that distance, it actually has lived up to that hype.
Well, once again, this is a first-time viewing for both of you. So, Adam, I'll ask you, you know, having now seen The Batman, which is how the Matt Reeves connection ties into this coincidentally, and you've seen Cloverfield, were you curious about watching this now, having seen arguably the movies that got, I would say, Reeves the Batman gig?
I was definitely curious to finally get around to seeing it. In the lead up to it, I was like, all right, well, just watch the other. It's amazing that this one took so long. You know, those first five, you got a sequel every year after Burton and Marky Mark's commercially successful but lauded film. It's no surprising they took some time off. But Rise was very well received, or decently received, and it was profitable. So it's strange that it took so long, but, you know, that is what it is. But that delay kept me away from seeing it initially. I was ready to get into it for this retrospective. Then I watched the trailer for it, which I normally didn't do, but I knew I'd seen it in the past, so this trailer is horrible, this film, I gotta say. It doesn't do this film any favors. So I was anticipatory, and then I watched the trailer getting ready for it, and I gotta say, it lowered my expectations right back down to earth, the same that they were years ago.
I love how 10 years later, you watched the trailer right before you watched the movie. Just like a moviegoer, like thinking, oh, that didn't really do us any good. And I remember that being the talk at the time, too, that trailer wasn't that good.
The only thing that I remember was exactly what I remember this time is, hey, Commissioner Gordon is standing up showing, and other than that, I know nobody in this film. And that's not true. I recognized one other person in this film, and I didn't know her connection to Matt Reeves. I didn't realize the series that he had done. But yeah, also after the Batman, it was curious to kind of see his take on this, because I wasn't familiar with Matt Reeves, I thought. And then I realized I've seen more of his work than I ever gave him credit for.
Speaking of seeing work, as alluded to, they did want a sequel, they being 20th Century Fox, as quickly as possible. As we mentioned on the last week's show, Wyatt had certainly left it open and did emphatically say this is just the beginning. One of the writers even said, we've set up some clues for where potential sequels could go. And within a couple months, Serkis said, yep, I'm coming back for a sequel. I've signed on to do another one. It paid him a heavy seven-figure salary for him to do it. So he...
For him.
Yeah, didn't he get top bill?
He's top billed on this one, which kind of makes sense, given he was the thing that most people remember about the first one. And within a year later, they announced the sequel. Title was announced as Dawn of Planet of the Apes, and that was in May of 2012. In September of 2012, Wyatt left the project. Reason he did was not entirely said, but the big one is that he did not think he could meet the May 2014 release date, which is the same rationale we heard when Bryan Singer left X-Men 3, among other things, notably Superman Returns. But that Fox is, more so than any studio I could think of, they were dead set on, we want this movie out by this date, and if you can't deliver it, we'll find someone who can.
As somebody who has worked for that studio, that is a mandate over there. They set your dates, and you must meet them no matter what. And they are very diligent about that, and they will do everything possible to make sure you meet that deadline. And so Wyatt, I'm sure, was feeling the pressure. You know, last time, he didn't really have that much pressure on him with Rise. And after Rise became a pretty big success, and as you said in the intro, they doubled the budget. He has even more responsibility here. He's got a hell of a lot of CGI here. I would cower in a corner too, honestly, and that sounds like that's exactly what he did. He went on to have a really good career, but I would have been curious to know how far he would have taken the apes. Although, as we've mentioned and when we discuss these series, guys, different visions in this is a very good thing. And Matt Reeves, as I mentioned last week, did, I thought, a really good job with the Let the Right One In remake that he had done. I know he had done Cloverfield. I think of that more as a J.J. Abrams project than a Matt Reeves project. I was sad for Wyatt, but I was happy that Reeves was actually getting a chance to dig in and do something bigger than he did last time.
I want to say perspective of the audience, because I don't want that to sound as dismissive as it is. But I will say, as a representative of the audience, I resent every single time that I'm told a release date. And there's no other information, there's not a script, actors aren't finalized, directors aren't set in stone, because I know either it's going to be a shit show, it's going to be punted, or it's going to end up just being sloppy and unfinished effects, i.e. Disney the last 3 years. So that's the type of thing that will always, always put me off is, and I know it's standard, I know I'm going to get the argument here, especially from Garrett, that that's the way Hollywood does it. But you know what? I don't give a shit. I hate it. I hate it. I hate it.
You're not going to hear any argument here because it does hamper creativity. It hampers somebody's ability to take what he has been given and make full use of it. You know, you're doing it just to get it done. You're not going to hear me say that doesn't hurt somebody's creativity.
Well, these weekends have become stunts. I mean, they like having specific dates, and it's just, I don't know, it's a game of one-upmanship from studio to studio, and I think we're starting to get the chickens coming to roost the last while for the way the studios have treated these. Hey, I'm going to claim this date 4 years in advance with nothing but a name.
Well, we'll talk about that in detail when we get to Star Wars, concluding Disney's time frame, because their main date was new Star Wars movie every year until they saw what happened. Kind of blew up in their face. But you're right on one of those fronts. They did punt on this. It went from May of 2014 to July of 2014. And I think part of that rationale was they did not want to be sandwiched in between The Amazing Spider-Man 2 and X-Men Days of Future Past, both of which were May 2014 releases.
And both had amazing buzz, even well in advance. Those were two names that people were very excited about.
Yeah, and it seemed to work much better for X-Men than it did for Spider-Man.
I was going to say, I don't think Spider-Man had that good a buzz, especially after that previous one. And we'll get to Spider-Man eventually, but I don't see the rationale of apes bunting, especially after the critical success of that last film, to avoid being hit by Andrew Garfield's Amazing Spider-Man.
Would have been hit. I don't know. We'll never know. But Fox also, X-Men was theirs. So...
Yeah, of course. They're competing with each other. I get it.
You had a return of somebody who had some level of power at Fox who probably also said, I will not compete with anything else from the studio.
And remember, look, 10 years ago, this was a crowded summer. I know we say that every year, but I was looking back, and so these are the big tentpole releases that came out this summer season, quote-unquote. Amazing Spider-Man 2, which got mixed reviews, but did make a good amount of money. X-Men Days of Future Past, Transformers 4, 2014 Ninja Turtles, Captain America the Winter Soldier, Guardians of the Galaxy, Maleficent. Like, it was a 22 Jump Street. There was something every weekend, sometimes multiple big releases on a single weekend.
That was actually the summer I actually got the gig at 20th Century Fox. It was late summer, early fall that I got that gig. And... I mean, you hit the wall running in this. You jump in, and they give you no leeway to learn the ropes. You are in it to win it, and 20th Century Fox had that mentality. That's why we saw so many movies being released that year.
I will say, as it pertains to Matt Reeves, I was indifferent when he was hired. I think his Let the Right One In remake is fine, but it pales in comparison to the original, not just because they're vampires and they have pasty complexions, but... While I don't like Cloverfield, I will say that there's some pretty inventive stuff with how he directs the movie, which is more than I can say about anything J.J. Abrams has directed. So I'm kind of glad he did it instead of Abrams, which you're right, it did have that whole mystery box bullshit type of advertising, which worked really well. I mean, you talk about this movie having a shitty trailer, Cloverfield has one of the best trailers you'll ever see.
That trailer is amazing.
Like, I would put that as one of the 10 best, you know, teaser trailers you would ever see. But I'm not going to say this was a direct for hire job by any means, but Reeves getting this gig did not really change or fluctuate my excitement. While I did like Rise of the Planet of the Apes a lot, I would be lying to you guys if I said I was waiting in line to get a sequel right away.
Interesting. Were you there opening weekend?
Because I make it an attempt to go to these big releases opening weekend, especially back then. And I gotta say, it was a packed theater for what you would expect, because when you think of Planet of the Apes, it's always been, as we've talked about, it's well known, everyone knows Planet of the Apes. It's got a fan base, but it's not on the level of a Star Wars or a Marvel or even Star Trek, you know, some of those other bigger sci-fi properties.
Yeah, you're right. Even though it's older than most of those, not Star Trek, but it doesn't have like the fanatics that those other franchises that you mentioned have. And even though these movies come out and they are always very successful, even that Wahlberg movie, we really ripped it to shreds, but truth is that movie made money because it was an apes movie. So it's amazing to think, you know, just how successful this franchise is without being a huge presence at cons and things. It's crazy to think about.
We also talk about marketing with these movies. While the trailers were bad, the viral marketing for this movie was very strong. They had a simian flu website done. They had mock PSA videos. Because this movie, they announced, yeah, it's taking place 10 years after the last one. So that's, you know, a big jump in time. Which is why James Franco and Freda Pinto both said, yeah, we're not in it. Like that was publicized well in advance.
My favorite part of... James Franco not being in this is he had no idea that he was even in it with his little bit of footage that they show in this movie. He had no idea that was even there. He's like, I think I probably got a little ripped off. I should have been paid for that.
Read that too. That is like, you think they would let a guy know and ask my permission.
Yeah.
Well, the last thing they'll want to do is pay actors more than they have to.
Exactly. And if you...
you were in the last movie, but you weren't the selling point.
No, you weren't the selling point. They got the star, the real star of the last movie for sure. But if you have somebody who was in Spider-Man, or you have, you know, this guy who's going to be in Genesis the next year, you pick the cheaper one, and I'm pretty sure that Jason Clarke was the cheaper one.
Well, there's also, they got Serkis locked in quickly because the Hobbit movies were about to go into production.
They were about to go in production? They were already in production. Right. Wasn't the second one out this year?
No, the second one came out in the third one came out this year, but I'm talking about like when they announced the sequel to Rise.
Oh, okay. I got you.
Circus was doing second unit direction on them.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, because there's a few years in between. Yeah.
So played Gollum again, so he let's get him and make sure that we pay him enough to not phone this in, and also to make sure he's available, because look, if you don't get Circus back for this, I don't know if you could replace him. You know, you can't really recast him.
No, yeah. And we've talked before that his involvement behind the scenes, his actual physical and production type work with Weta and with the motion capture has really been one of the things that have catapulted the quality in the industry so far. Because he's not just somebody who puts the dots on, he is involved intimately behind the scenes. And I think getting him involved is really part of the things that have taken this quality to the stratosphere.
And speaking of quality, this thing got lavished with praise as being kind. Not only were people saying this was one of the best movies of the summer, it was on a lot of top 10 lists, period. It got some Oscar buzz, ultimately didn't get that. It lost Best Visual Effects, which Rise of Planet of the Apes also lost, which is just crazy when you look at how pioneering a lot of this technology is. But timing is always a big thing with the Oscars, and made almost $800 million, so it was the highest grossing of the franchise.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, I mean, a lot of that is what helped Matt Reeves get that Batman gig.
Yeah. Well, it's been 10 years since this movie came out, which is fitting considering this movie begins 10 years after the flu outbreak. They were very smart when they made this prologue. It's like, all right, how do we bring people up to speed and reestablish or reintegrate you into this world? Well, they show this giant map of the world, and you see the different... So it's literally the movie Contagion. Like, you're seeing it spread worldwide.
Yeah.
And this shit hits totally different now post-COVID, where they're talking about, staying inside, the death toll, you're seeing kids get infected. Like, this is as dour an opening for a summer blockbuster that you will ever see.
It's funny you mentioned Contagion, too, because this actually had ghost rewrites done by the writer of Contagion. Scott Z. Burns is his name. He worked with Soderbergh on a few films, including Contagion. It's a really good montage. It really gets you involved. You definitely get a feel after the end of that last movie that everything that was prophesized is pretty much coming true. I mean, humans are being wiped out, and here are these apes taking over. So we automatically get the feeling with these newscasts and everything. And I normally don't like this use of news in films. You know, I think it's kind of lazy. But in this instance, I think Reeves and company did a good job of integrating it in to catch you up to speed. Because like you said, this takes place 10 years later.
Yeah, and I think what mattered for those that remember, you know, yes, pre-COVID, but there was H1N1, swine flu, bird flu. Like, all these things were in the consciousness, so it makes sense, but this is a really good shorthand. But also, by basically replaying the credit scene from Rise of the Planet of the Apes, it does that nod to all the previous films, where you kind of got the ending to set up the sequels, which you got in those original series. And it does that here, but in a different way. You know, it changes the color from yellow to red, you got some additional exposition going on, but you're pretty much retelling the closing of that film to start this one. Good move, because obviously you got a lot more fans packed into theaters for this one than you did the first one, even though that one was successful. So you've got to set them off on the right foot. You've got to know where we are, and good way to do it. I like the news scenario, but I generally do, so I think this is a smart way to go.
Yeah, I'm in Garrett's camp, where I'm not crazy about using this type of storytelling to showcase exposition. But I think it works because it actually reflects contemporary things at the time. And with a 10-year gap, you have to find a way to show the fall of human civilization. And the key detail is also, well, there's two of them. They say only about 1 in 500 are genetically immune. So you've got that out of the way to explain why there's actually a big colony of survivors, relatively speaking. The second is, yeah, there's a simian flu. But we're also complacent in wiping ourselves out, because they talk about riots,
yes,
and the violence that the previous films have always alluded to. So I like that it carries over into this reboot. That, yeah, the apes spawned the virus or spread it, but it stems from human creation and our destruction. We have a hand in that as well.
Which could be its own film. Like, you can have one that literally shows the downfall of humanity, and I think something would be compelling there. And to gloss over it is always the nature of these apes films. And you miss that point, but you never really miss it.
Nobody in this movie has a halo over their head. Nobody in this movie is innocent. And I do like that, Matt, like you mentioned, that apes, yeah, they started this thing, but humans, they aren't innocent in this. They have every bit to do with their own destruction as the apes do. And this does a good job of showing that.
Speaking of self-destruction, I'm sure regular moviegoers were very surprised that the first 15 minutes of this movie has no dialogue. It is all reintegrating you into the ape civilization, which is, I have to compliment them for this, because you think 10 years would be more than enough justification for them to have the apes fully speaking English like they do in the other films, but we're still at a point where they communicate through sign language. Like, they're not giving speeches or anything.
Mm-hmm. I like the idea of this, but I'm going to get a big complaint out of the way right now. Look, I want to have a lot of good things to say about the special effects in this movie. The special effects in this movie are amazing, through and through, almost all the way through, except in this chase of these elk. This has video game scene written all over it, and there's so many of these fucking elk. It was too computer generated for me. There's just too many of the computer graphics in the way, and that took me out of it for a bit. But you're right. Like, I like the way that, you know, we're not having them speak to each other, where they're signing to each other. It helps the expressions, and of course we have Circus here doing everything that Circus does, which is amazing. But yeah, the opening scene of them going after these elk kind of got me off on the wrong foot.
I liked the scene because I found it reminiscent to the original one, but I was put off by the way that they were hunting, because it seemed like the apes would be smarter, and I wonder if they were just hampered by the technology when you're processing so many, but they should be descending from trees. I don't get the apes running across by humans, but it's a cool scene, and yeah. To your point, Matt, I wasn't expecting this to open so dialogue-free for so long. I think I'm going to be doing stuff while I'm taking my notes and watching the movie. Uh-uh. This movie looked at me, slapped me in the face, and said, hey, pay fucking attention if you want to hear anything, because it's all going to be in subtitles from signing. And I was glad it did, because it made me pay attention to that much more.
Here, I don't know what it is about deer and elk, but they never look right when it comes to renderings. Because remember, I Am Legend... Mm-hmm. There's that scene where they're in the car, Will Smith and his dog are in the car, they chase after the deer. It looks as bad as that. But that's really my only knock in the effects. I think it's because there is the clear distinction between motion capture versus entirely computer-generated animals. There's always going to be that disconnect, especially when you put them in the same shot.
Yeah, it looked like a scene from that first Last of Us game. Like, just something that was done like five, 6 years ago that just does not look as good as if it was rendered today. Is what I'm saying. And yeah, these are 10-year-old effects, but the film gets these effects right during the course of it. Here, it doesn't look right to me.
The apes are their own colony. They're still in Muir Woods, where they've built this colony with tree houses, and they're not technologically advanced, but they survive, but they still hunt in a primitive way, because I feel bad for these horses, because I'm sure when they saw humanity get wiped out, they thought they were going to have their own uprising, but sure enough, the goddamn apes get on their backs.
I did like that little bit of irony, that the apes are using the horses.
Which, you know, if you know the original film franchise, that's wink there. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, they're hunting the less-than-stellar deer, and we get a better bear attack than what we'd see in The Revenant a year later, where Caesar has to fight off this grizzly bear, where he's assisted by Koba, who is one of the apes from the previous film. He was the one that was experimented on, and he's all scarred up. Change the actor. It's now Toby Kebbell doing the motion capture work. And speaking of people who got fucked over by Fox, I'll say Fantastic Four 2015 and leave it at that.
Shut up.
We'll talk about that sometime.
Harris not legally obligated. Harris not legally allowed to talk about that stuff.
No. Nope. Not yet.
I know he's not, but, you know.
This scene right here, I'm glad I didn't know much about it. It caught me off guard. It's a good little addition and plussing of the action scene. But I was like, I thought they might have killed Caesar right here at the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah, I did a double take as well.
Oh, this movie is really good at making you believe they will kill off Caesar at any point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they play that a couple times.
Yeah, they play that beat multiple times, but it works at each instance they choose to do it. And we're seeing more of Caesar's got a family now. He's thoroughly in charge, but he's got his own council of, you know, Koba, Maurice, Rocket, where he talks about they haven't seen humans in a long time, so they for all they know, humans could be just wiped out completely. They don't have much contact with them, but this is very much setting you up for a movie where it's entirely about the apes, if you hadn't seen the marketing.
It really is. And what they do with these effects in these beginnings, after we get past that badly rendered hunting scene, what they've done here, and when they show Caesar with his family, you know what this movie does? And I don't know if I mentioned it last week or not, but they make me not think about Andy Serkis doing these motions. I'm thinking of Caesar. You know, I'm seeing Caesar do these motions. I'm not seeing Andy Serkis. And all of it is so well done because they all feel so natural. You know, and I think that Serkis is so natural at this that I think in a lot of ways he got robbed of a freaking Academy Award nomination for this movie. I'll go ahead and say that right now, the way he performs in this movie.
Agreed. It's a shame that because it's mocap, it's never going to get a recognition, and that's a shame that needs to be addressed. Yeah, I like that it sets up, to your point, that it's been so long, because it's a simple little dialogue, quote-unquote, because that it's been 10 years, but we haven't seen human. We have not seen a human for at least the last two winters, as they put it. And I'm like, okay, that puts me in a time frame. I know it's been a decade, and nobody here has seen a human for at least 2 years, which means some of them would have never seen a human. It's little stuff that it puts me in their mindset. I know where these apes are, and I'm ready for it. I'm loving it.
But their isolation is short-lived, ultimately, because Caesar's son and Rocket's son come across one guy with a gun who is with a smaller subgroup of people from this colony that we'll find out about. So now we're setting up the thing of, oh shit, the humans are here, but then the humans realize not only are the apes still on their own, but they're capable of speech. And they're like, all right, this will probably not end well for us.
Yes.
But you used the term that I wrote down. It's my biggest note was humans. Oh shit, oh shit, oh shit. This is such an oh shit moment, the way it's directed and acted out. There's a sense of suspense and terror when they come around and see these apes. It's weird to get the emotion out of here, because you know they're going to interact, you know they're going to come across each other, but the tension in here feels so real for just humans coming across CG apes.
Well, it does the thing that I think the first Jurassic Park movie does really well, where you feel like they're actually interacting with animals that they shouldn't be interacting with. Like, I don't have that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the uncanny valley thing that I have with certain other movies where I'm like, I feel like these exist in the same shot, in the same sequence, in the same world. The human actors also, they don't talk necessarily a whole lot with the apes. You know, there's not a whole lot of monologuing, but the way they interact, there's always this uneasiness with all their conversations.
I think there's something to be said about being able to mocap and act against and off one another, because I think it comes through. And yeah, I think the lack of dialogue is this could play as a silent movie with a great score, and it would be effective. But yeah, there's just something challenging about it, especially when you get, for the humans, not necessarily great actors, wonderful thespians, but it plays well in the story they're telling.
Hey, they got Felicity here. Old friend of Matt Reeves from his days of working on Felicity. Yeah, and Jason Clark, too, who is a guy who's kind of like Jeffrey Wright to me, where every time he comes on screen, I just kind of cringe a little bit. Like, they both seem to play people who are just kind of punchy in the dicky. You know, you just want to get them to fuck off the screen half the time. I do, anyway. But you know what? They're very endearing. And I like Clark and Carrie Russell as a couple in this. You know, the humans, I think Matt Reeves, as hard as he worked on the apes, I think he worked just as hard on the humans in this to get them so that they are interacting with these apes in a way that is culpable, in a way that is very believable. Because like you said, Adam, it's been 10 years since most of these apes have even seen a human. So I think the way he has outlined these humans is a great way for these apes to interact with them.
You brought up one, so I'll bring up one. I like Carrie Russell. I could use more of her, but I think she's brought forward just to show that Clark maybe has an ability to act somewhere in his resume. But I'm really glad Carrie Russell's in it, because I find Clark to be as damp as the ape's fur in the rain. I could use so much less of him throughout this film.
All right, so I gotta break the tie once again, as I often do on these shows. So I'm going to start with my backhanded compliment. I think the human predicament in this movie and their interactions are really good. But I wish I had that emotional resonance to their story that I did in the first one with, you know, the Alzheimer's thing. The parallels are here with Caesar and Malcolm, as far as, you know, they both have their own families that they're trying to protect, and they're kind of leaders that are running into opposition, but not against outright villains. So that's my thought on that. That's the one thing I think I'm lacking from this film that I got in the first one. But I'm with Adam 100% on Jason Clarke and Kerry Russell. I think she is fine, but outside of... So here's my thing about Jason Clarke. I like him in small doses. Like, give him bit roles like Oppenheimer, I can tolerate him. When he's front and center or is an integral plot to these type of movies, like between this and Terminator Genesis shit, I think he's not a strong presence. And I'm insulted that you put him and Jeffrey Wright in the same sentence, because Jeffrey Wright acts circles around him in sleep and could act circles around him in a coma.
I didn't say he couldn't act circles around him. I just said I don't like him. And then, by the way, I didn't say Jason Clarke was great here. I just think the way that Matt Reeves has outlined him, it's kind of like the way Patty Jenkins does with Gal Gadot in that first Wonder Woman movie, where she's not doing a great job, but you still really like her. I think he's being produced very well in this. You know, it's kind of like Madonna. You know, Madonna, she can't really sing that well, but man, she is produced so well, and most of her music comes off very well. And I think Jason Clarke's kind of the same way.
They did have an uphill battle for me, because I do remember, and this was one of my issues with not seeing it originally, though it wasn't fully conscious, was you got to introduce a complete new set of human characters for me. And I do think that's a challenge, but as we've said before, the humans aren't the driving force of these stories. They tried to be a little more in this one, but you still need to make me care about the humans that you are going to bring to screen.
And I will go with Matt on this. I think where Silver and Jaffa, the writers of this, and probably Scott C. Burns too, I think what Silver and Jaffa did so well last time was put that Alzheimer's plot point there to make you care. And I don't think there's anything here to really make you care for these human characters. I think it's all about the interaction.
What you should have had, and we haven't got to that plot specifically, is you should have had the two fathers trying to care for their wives and get the same thing out of it. But you don't have that. You should have had literally a mirror situation between Clarke and Caesar. Sorry, I can't even remember his name. Jason Clarke and Caesar.
Exactly.
So I had a thought, because this movie's all about getting the power, because they're running short of it. Have Gary Oldman's, one of his kids, have them survive and be on life support. And they need the power to keep him alive or something. You have that human connection outside of just, because this movie's basically a Captain Planet episode. If we got to turn on the dam. To keep the lights.
I get a better analogy.
Or have Gary Oldman on set for longer than 3 days, which I'm assuming he was.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, you should have had Gary Oldman and Jason Clarke switch roles.
There you go. Yeah, there's an idea.
He looks like he just finished his speech in The Dark Knight Rises and walked right across the other soundstage.
Yeah. Got a megaphone again. Caesar walks, he tells them to go, and when I say tell, I mean yell, because he's not too happy about seeing humans invading his space, so the humans return to their colony, which is, logistically, this movie makes a whole lot of sense. I like that it still takes place in San Francisco. The humans are in basically the remnants of the Genesis building, or whatever it was from the last movie. I like that we're still tying it in, and I like that the humans are still civilized. It's kind of like I would compare this to, this is a shitty movie, but how humanity's presented in Ready Player One, where we're all just living on top of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And look, if there's one guy you want leading you in the face of, you know, the near apocalypse, it'd probably be Gary Oldman, because he's the biggest name in this movie by far, outside of Andy Serkis. And he's good here, but as you said, Gary, he's only here for 3 days, and I could have used a whole lot more of him.
Yeah, why have him if he's only going to be in the background and not an integral part of what they're doing here?
Yeah, I wonder if he was signed on initially and originally, and as stuff got rewritten and changed, he said, look, you've now cut down my time, and this is what you're going to get. Figure it out. I'm not going to extend my time on set.
Well, he has said that he's taken roles just for paycheck, and it's quite obvious if you look at a lot of his resume from the late 90s on, that he did take roles just for specifically for paychecks. I remember when this movie was coming out, he was big in interviews by saying he actually really, really liked this script, and he was anxious to do this one and bring his all into it. And I'm thinking, God damn, like, you brought it all for 3 days. And I'm just making that assumption. I don't know if it was exactly that amount of time, but it sure as hell seems like it, because he's not on screen that much.
It could have been a conscious decision to say, hey, we can't let him be the, you know, if he's in here for half of it, he will be the focus. And it could be a conscious decision to say, we can't he was Commissioner Gordon, you know, to everybody. We can't let him be the focus of this film.
We're starting to see that, you know, the humans that are here, they're running out of power, and they need, you know, their mission was reconnaissance, but they ran into the apes. But Caesar's sort of pressured by Koba, who clearly has justifiable reasons for hating humans as much as he does. He tells Caesar we should go and, you know, go to war with them, but Caesar kind of plays the middle ground of showing force, where he takes basically all the apes on horseback in front of the human colony and tells them, look, don't start nothing, there won't be nothing, for lack of a better word.
This is a beautifully done scene. This march of the apes into the human civilization, wow.
Oh, it's awesome.
Just wow.
Yeah. And it's believable when they put them in the same shot.
Yes.
But the apes show just a little bit of compassion because they returned the kid's book bag back, because remember, knowledge is power, everybody. And they basically depart saying, look, we won't bother you as long as you stay on, you know, here's the line, don't cross it. Because Caesar is, he has compassion for humans in a certain way, but as this movie establishes, he has not seen Franco and company since the end of the last movie. So he's been entirely with his own kind for the last decade.
Yeah, and it's written on his face, too, like, literally. Like, he's got kind of war paint on, and, you know, the effects artist also did a really good job of rendering his face as looking aged, you know, since the last film. And it's amazing to see the evolution of this ape from when we saw him as a pre-Twilight baby way back in 2011. And this takes place 10 years later, and here he is, just established and all set for war. And he is the one who is the middle ground. As you said, Matt, he's playing the middle ground here. And again, a lot of it comes down to circus, but you got to give the effects artist credit too, because the expressions and everything that this ape does and the war paint and the things that he's doing in this are really just doing a really good job of outlining this character for us.
There's a lot here, especially because in continuing with the previous film, Caesar doesn't talk a whole lot. So he's still having to do a lot physically and with the technology. Caesar says that the apes don't want war, but they'll fight to defend themselves, and they depart. Gary Oldman, Dreyfus, and Malcolm have a conversation about, you know, we need that dam to, A, keep power going because they're running low, and also try to connect with the outside world because these humans have not had any civilization contact. So for all they know, they could be the last of us, no pun intended. And I will
nice.
Say, you know, this plot feels very... I don't know how much I could knock the movie for this, but I do find a lot of the beats in this movie to be very predictable, and this feels like they were just relying on what The Walking Dead was doing at the time. Like, this
you
is
know
the
what?
Plot, so many Walking Dead episodes, where they have to go do something, they run into a civilization that's not what you think it is, there's an obvious villain, like, that's the one thing this movie doesn't have, is an obvious villain, but a lot of the plot, I just don't find to be that interesting.
Isn't Koba the villain?
Yes, but he's got justifiable reasons for doing so.
Well, that's what good villains have.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm with you. At this point, this plot is doing nothing for me. I'm enjoying going along with these apes. I'm enjoying a lot of what I'm seeing, the eye candy in front of me and everything. But at this point, I'm exactly lockstep with you, Matt. This plot is taking me nowhere, and I'm really wondering what the hell all the fuss was about in 2014.
Oh my goodness, I thought I was going to be the only one that at this point of the movie, I'm wondering what all the excitement was all about. You know, the apes look good, I like this march into the city and all that, but as this is going, I'm like, I don't want to say bored, but I'm not like excited and drawn in. I'm just like, oh, can we get going? I'll say we get there, but when it comes to the plot and everything else that's going on, my big part of it is I played this movie when it was called The Last of Us. And I'm not just going to say that because of the looks, though I do think that they actually got data and actually got stuff from Naughty Dog, because I swear to goodness, some of these set extensions, some of these CG sets they use for mocap later, I've been there. And because I've done it so many times, I know the layout. So I think that they reused assets. And it's not bad, but I know them. I know them well. It's just cleaned up and they changed the shading. But also, the plot of this, to go to the dam to get power, that is the center of the first game. And I know it's a lot of post-apocalyptics, go to the dam, get the power. But yeah, retreading something that is so used, but when I see something that is in The Last of Us look like The Last of Us, and I'm going back to the game. Yes, the show, but yada yada, but no, I'm going back and back because of the time spent. It's distracting me because I've done it, and there are no surprises to be had for quite a while.
Wow, comparing this to The Last of Us video game, that's a bold strategy, Cotton.
The first one, though, and look at the time frame. That first one was released years beforehand. How did they do that game? It was all mocap.
That game came out 2 years before this.
Yes, but that game started development in 2009 and started mocap in 2010. Mm. It's a video game. It's a 5-year process.
Understood. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Making a movie, too.
Yeah. I see assets being reused, and I see storylines, though, there have been reused over and over. I just see too much of a similarity going on.
I have to say, I'm so happy I'm not fighting this alone, because I was terrified I was going to be the sole person making this critique, because this has been my axe to grind for the last 10 years. I'm like, yeah, I like this movie. I think it's beautiful to look at, and there's some things in this that I think are great, but I'm missing that really strong hook that the first one had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's just it. There's no hook here. Matt Reeves has laid this out beautifully, but he's not hooking me. Hell, even Cloverfield had a wonderful hook. I'm not feeling any of that here.
Because I don't care if the humans live or die, really, because none of them I care about. I mean, other than Carrie Russell being pretty, I don't care about the rest of these humans. What do I care?
At least she has her hair in this one.
It looks good.
We'll be reading her again when we do Mission Impossible.
And Star Wars.
And Star Wars, yeah.
God.
Speaking of people, that's what her and Andy Serkis have in common. They were both wasted in Disney Star Wars. So he gives them a couple days to go, but they're going to go check the armory to make sure that they need to defend themselves if need be. So I like that the humans are not stupid in this movie. Because the one thing I will really compliment this movie for, the first Rise of the Planet of the Apes is really a remake of Conquest. It's like Matt Reeves watched Battle and said, how can I make this but not make it suck? Because it's that same thing of we know there's going to be a fight, and you also have an ape that is going to overthrow Caesar.
Yeah, we've been talking so much about how he has established this world and the plot and everything. We have just thrown out the window that this is a Planet of the Apes movie. And yeah, I thought so much of Battle of the Planet of the Apes when I was watching this. I could not believe how many parallels there were.
And I do think it's, this is why I like this reboot franchise as much as I do, is that they really take elements from all the other movies, but they work as both reboots and actual like remakes. Because the first one is really close to Conquest in a lot of ways. This one is really close to Battle. And we'll talk about the third one next week. So that part I really praise it for. I think everything with the apes in this movie is great. I think Kova is a really strong antagonist. I like how him and Caesar don't see eye to eye. I will say, though, that later on this movie has the Lion King problem. Not just because it literally becomes the Lion King, but also it's like, okay, all the apes just side with Kova right away.
Mm.
I mean, they imprison all the ones that are loyal to Caesar, but that's like three of them.
One bus. Yeah.
It's one bus. But, you know, we cut back Caesar's having conversations about, you know, what do we do? And the humans return with, again, why are you bringing the same group of people that Caesar told to fuck off the first time? They at least make sense. Okay, why do you have the stupid guy with the gun? He's the only one who knows how to work the dam. So they answer that question, but there's no reason to bring the kid. I hate this trope in movies where we have to bring the kid along just because they're rebellious and they want to help out.
Yeah. Because Ellie and Joel were a thing. Yeah. They got the damn wrong group of people here. I'll say that.
I don't know if I'm laughing with that or at it.
That's an at. Little.
I know. That's a damn shame.
Yeah, this whole conversation is water under the bridge. So Malcolm goes on his own to plead with Caesar to go and allow him to work on the dam. Caesar agrees on the provision that they turn over their guns. More on this later, because I have huge problems with this plot point, because they seemingly turn over all their guns, but of course they have to create artificial tension, so you have the one stupid guy, again, sneaks in a gun.
Why would Malcolm let this guy, you almost got us killed at the beginning. Why would he let him come along? Maybe it's right, the damn script.
Well, they explain it because he's the only one who knows how the dam works.
Yeah.
But also, why is this guy such an asshole? You had this in movies all the time, too. Like, Walking Dead had this problem throughout the entirety of that show. There's always that one character who doesn't act the way even, like, people with bad morals act smartly, like the governor or Negan. This guy would not last in the apocalypse if he was this dumb.
I mean, you could do it with the line, let him be a bigot to say, my family died of simian flu, damn these dirty apes. I can't believe they left out that line, thank goodness. But you could have had something similar to explain that he's a bigot because of simian flu and he blames them for our extinction.
He does say that around the campfire, but that's all we need. I like that conversation later on, but like the thing with the gun, I hate that so much because we have to contrive a way for the humans to be told to screw off again. But as I mentioned, you know, Caesar lets them start working on the dam. Meanwhile, Dreyfus and company are going to the armory, and Koba goes to put on a glorified minstrel show, play the dumb stereotype of the ape. I do like how this comes back a second time.
Yeah.
I love the beginning of this with them climbing behind them while they're firing. And you just, I mean, that's a horror movie moment of the apes just dangling overhead while these freaking numbskulls are firing over and over into this vehicle.
Yeah, why are you wasting ammunition?
Well, because apparently they have every weapon that has ever been made on the planet in this one warehouse.
Yeah, they say...
There are a lot of weapons
Cuba
here.
Cuba was walking around with rocket launchers and machine guns.
In San Francisco. Guess what? If there's one place you're not going to get a lot of weapons, it's the armory here in the Bay Area of California. Maybe if they were in the Presidio, because there is a former military installation about six blocks... closer than the San Bruno... animal facility from the first one, but we don't ever see Presidio in this film.
So when Koba comes back, he, excuse me the pun, he goes ape shit at Caesar for saying, like, you know, why are you helping the humans? You love the humans more than you love us. And him and Caesar have the first of a couple fights they have. But I love how this movie, we talk about things that they pull from the original. Much like Battle, this movie does that ape will not kill ape, but reverses it in a lot of ways.
Yeah, they really do play with that, don't they? I thought that was a really nice callback and a nice way of integrating it into the plot.
I agree. And we see it at the beginning of the film when we're panning through Ape City because it's written on the wall behind Maurice. So It's something that has been taught, and then we get it fleshed out throughout the rest of this. And it matters quite a bit. It's a nice callback as well.
And Caesar sort of, he shows empathy for the humans. But he still keeps them at a distance, because even when they go to treat his wife, he says, like, you can stay for one day. Do what you have to do, and then get out. So I like that Caesar is not, he's not, this is almost like a Shakespearean conflict that they're setting up in this movie. It's kind of it's got some, like, elements of Coriolanus, where he gets turned on by his own, you know, his own kind. So you have to do that because there's so little dialogue with the apes.
So little dialogue, and I love that scene. I do really like that scene where he just tells them, you have one day. Get your shit together and get the fuck out. And again, Serkis is doing it with his face. You know, you're seeing just the scowl and the kind of like, okay, I have vouched for you guys. You guys need to get your shit done and get out.
Caesar's not, he's not stupid. He's not even innocent. He's an ape between two worlds. You know, he was the one, as you mentioned, he was the one that interacted with the humans, but he's not of them. So there's so much there, and he plays it amazingly well.
Makes me wish that Matt Reeves did Man of Steel
in
a lot of ways, because like, I like that he's being portrayed as Superman in a lot of ways, where, yeah, there's some Jesus parallels, Moses parallels he's leading his people, but he's got that I don't know 100% my place thing, and even at the end of this movie, he's not at that full-fledged spot yet. So while things are relatively harmonious, Carver sneaks in a shotgun in the box, so Caesar sees that, throws it in the water, and tells them to get out. Koba goes back to the armory a second time, kills the two guards, and returns home, and he pulls a Dennis Nedry and kills him in the car, which I thought was funny.
Bringing back Jurassic Park.
Yeah, and I have to ask a question about Matt Reeves, because this is going to sound joking, I promise it's not. Has Matt Reeves ever seen a sunny day in his life? Between this and the Batman, he loves rain.
He does. I think he's a big Fincher guy because he's one of those guys who there's always something going on in the frame. You know, I noticed it a lot in the Let Me In remake as well, where, you know, I just watched that movie recently. So I it's kind of fresh in my mind where, you know, he's got the camera in the car during the car accident. Like, there's always something going on within frame. And whether it's rain, whether it's a car accident, whether it's somebody playing with a gun in the background as people are talking, like, he's always got something else you want to focus on. And you know what? I think that can be a wise tool to use. It can be overdone, but I think Reeves does a nice job with the direction here. I really do.
Well, I like to think this movie is dour for a blockbuster, certainly. I mean, you compare this to Guardians of the Galaxy, yeah, which came out a couple weeks later. It's like no contest. But I also like that a lot of the scenes, they're very quiet. Mm-hmm. There is a score here by Giacchino, but oftentimes it's background music.
Yeah, it's not memorable. Again, this is my same complaint with this guy, and I'm going to keep saying it, because we're going to fucking go over this guy's music during Star Wars and every other fucking franchise we're going to be doing, because apparently he's the only guy who does music in the series of movies we're doing this year. Like, his music is not memorable at all, and this is the same way. I try pulling clips from this to try to get good background music for it, and you can't. Like, he doesn't have anything that resonates with you. It's all background, as you mentioned.
I also, throughout all of this, I'm like, why are we making Jason Clarke and family the sole human focus? Gary Oldman does more in that one scene when he looks at that frickin' iPad than Jason Clarke does through this entire fucking movie.
I also don't completely get him and Kerry Russell's relationship. Like, I felt like they were just colleagues, then are they together? Are they not? Like, maybe I missed something, but I'm not fully understanding what's supposed to be going on there.
I guess they're together. It's like a step. She's like the kid's stepmother.
Yeah, I got the feeling it was a stepmother situation.
I don't think it's ever said if they're, like, married. Obviously, you know, it's not like they go to a church, you know, or anything like that. They don't need a marriage license, so. But
well, yeah, no, it could have been we found ourselves in the loss of, I mean, she talks about losing her family, but that's as far as that goes.
Honestly, I would have been fine if it was just the kid that was with him, because him and Caesar have parallels.
Yeah.
In certain ways where, you know, he's learning about ape culture through Maurice giving him books. I like all that stuff, but, okay, Kerry Russell is the nurse who takes care of the Caesar's wife. The kid has a bond with Maurice. The asshole guy can fix the dam. What is Jason Clarke's purpose? Besides stealing money on his salary for being a shitty actor. Like, this guy makes me miss Sam Worthington in this movie.
I love when Matt focuses on one actor and he keeps railing him.
I like him in Oppenheimer because he plays a dick.
Yeah, I mean, look, the guy doesn't put any lead in my pencil either. I just think he's a presence here just made to interact with the apes. Nothing more, nothing less. Like, I don't think we are made to care for him. I think we are made to look at the situation he's in and think, what would we do?
I mean,
you know, there's no real emotional resonance anyone's supposed to be having with him, I don't think.
That's a really good point. If the idea was to give us a human that I don't care about, they worked. Good job.
So Caesar sends them all back, and Koba takes this opportunity to snipe Caesar and seemingly kill him, but he does it in secret. Nobody sees him fire the gun. You know, it's funny that Jason Clarke's in this movie, because this plays like the Kennedy assassination, where it's a conspiracy.
In front of everybody, but where no one else can see it.
Yeah, you've got 100-plus apes, and nobody just happens to be looking at Caesar.
And he's standing there posing with it, you know, for time before and after. I mean, it's a conceit. It's just one that I had a hard time being that nobody else would see this. Or see him with a gun. Or that he knew how to use a gun.
There's also the thing of, I know we're talking about logic in an apes movie, but look, these movies are a lot smarter than your typical science fiction. Or summer blockbusters, for that matter. So Koba says, yeah, the humans killed Caesar. We need to go, you know, guns a-blazing to wipe them out. Nobody stands up to Koba in that entire colony of apes. And the ones that do are imprisoned off screen. You might as well have had him start singing Be Prepared with Talking Hyenas. that's how this plays.
You're not wrong.
But as we find out, Caesar survives, you know, much like the Batman movies, somebody survives a fall that they really should not have.
Well, hang on, to get through something else that we're going to discuss, somehow Caesar survived.
Yeah.
Somehow Caesar returns.
He did bleed out and he survived the fall. So they find Caesar while Koba takes command of the army to San Francisco. So we're really setting up. This is the real battle of the Planet of the Apes that the fifth film promised but didn't actually deliver. And I will say, like, if you're here for spectacle and seeing the apes fight, this is where, on that blockbuster level, it certainly delivers.
This scene is amazing. And I'll say, you know, I've had, leading up to this, I mean, I think I've had less problems with the film than you two have had, but I've still had kind of some issues thinking, okay, what was the big deal? But this scene, from here on out, starting with this remarkable action scene, is fucking amazing. I am at a loss of words here to describe how gripped I was. You could not drill a nail through my ass with a sledgehammer. During this scene, I was sitting there, I was gripping so hard while I was watching it. Like, everything just surrounded me, and I was amazed by this scene.
Absolutely amazing effects and spectacle and tension that's going on as soon as we get this here. I mean, the movie, it takes a very long time to get going. And I know, yeah, you need to build up, you need the humans, but it's not just that it took a long time. I did not feel that it was done very well. This is superb. And I can't believe how well, you make this movie today, it's $400 million. You know, mm-hmm. And it still would not look this good. Like, the amount of care to get these many assets on screen. Okay, everybody wants to talk about the Battle of Tirith Minas in Lord of the Rings. Did I actually say that right? Holy
no,
shit.
It's Minas Tirith, so you were wrong.
Okay, good. Then that's proper for me and Lord of the Rings and the amount of characters on. But what this looks like, because this is clean. You believe this ape invasion. You really, really do. They look better than the humans.
Well, they're certainly more expressive than most of them. But yeah, I mean, like, as far as, like, summer blockbusters, the thing is also, it's not about, okay, stopping, you know, the bad guy from launching a sky portal or all the other stuff that a lot of these movies were doing. This one is just, we have to, it's the Helm's Deep principle. How's that for a Lord of the Rings parallel, where we just have to stand our ground and hope we don't get overrun?
Yeah. And at this point, I got to be honest, I felt like my mind was being set to wander. You know, like, I was just thinking, okay, when's something going to happen? And boy, does it happen here. Man, what a scene.
Yeah, it's almost like they heard you, and they're like, all right, we're going to step the game up. Because look, this the third act of this movie is as good as it gets from here on out, with between the action and the ultimate resolution, where they find Caesar, and they bring him. He sees his old house, and he goes in, and to the surprise of everyone, including James Franco, he has a cameo in this where they replay footage.
And I swear the only reason they found a way to put this in was because they needed that window symbol here in a minute. Because that's supposed to mean something that wasn't set up throughout the rest of the film that all the monkeys know about.
You know what? And what's weird is I seem to remember, I think we talked about this last week, but I seem to remember him dying in the last film, but we didn't actually see him die. But apparently he did, and they find a video. I mean, look, this isn't as outrageous as Iron Man 2, where they find a video of saying exactly how to beat the bad guy at the end of the movie, or inspire Tony Stark to do what he does at the end of that
it's
movie.
It's even dumber than that. It's, here's the cure to this element that is not on the periodic table, but because you're a super genius, you could figure it out.
That's where I was going. It just is outrageous.
Oh, I love Iron Man 2.
Okay. Shut up.
So they restore Caesar back to health. His son goes to see him, and he realizes that, Kova shot me, as if the son couldn't figure that out. Especially because Kova kills one of the kids by throwing him off the side of the roof or off the third floor, and nobody says, all right, that's too far.
To your point, as you said, that all the apes just go along with it without really much of an argument or discussion. You know, that it's very convenient that everybody's just going along for the ride here. We see one that he then again kills, but you don't have a big separation. And yes, by the end of this, obviously it's the setup for the next film. But this is just, Kobe says he's in charge, so everybody goes along.
That's my one.
Yeah. You know, it's a little sticking point when you're watching it, and then the action kicks in and you gloss over. But at the moment, in the moments where it takes a second to breathe, it's the type of thing you realize.
Especially because Caesar has never done anything that, for all we know, his followers have ever really fought him on. So it's the one thing I know 100% by. And they have to justify it by him imprisoning the ones that are loyal to Caesar, but I think it would be a lot more than just those few.
I don't know. I was getting the idea of watching this that there wouldn't be more than those
few. But you could have fleshed this out if you focused almost entirely on the apes. True. Have the humans working on the dam. We know that's happening, but spend another 10 minutes on some unsettling amongst the ranks beyond just a couple. Mm-hmm. Malcolm runs into Dreyfus, who's underground, and he reveals that they have made contact with some other humans, and they are going to... Sounds like there's military on the way. Here's where Malcolm does the dumb thing of holding them at gunpoint instead of just saying, hey, the apes need more time. I'm going to go to the furthest extreme and hold you hostage instead of explaining my point. Because so much of this movie, they have rational conversations, but because it's the third act, they have to ramp it up and say, okay, I'm going to go to the furthest extreme to prove my point.
This is where Okay, it's show, don't tell. So I never know if Dreyfuss is telling the truth. And by Dreyfuss, we mean Gary Oldman. Because every time I hear Dreyfuss, I think of Richard Dreyfuss, who could have been.
Yeah, it's the same way.
But, you know, I'm wondering if he's telling the truth or not. And then it's made clear that it actually is the truth. But I'm like, if that's the truth, why didn't you show us the character who's sitting there the entire time that we hear in the background making these calls? Give us 30 seconds of one call getting through. Because I don't know if this is real or not. And it's not supposed to be suspenseful as to whether it is true or not. So it doesn't matter. It's a weird sequence in the script that I don't understand the why for. But as the way for the guns and everything else, I think somebody came to Reeves and said, hey, all of these apes films are supposed to have a story about something. There needs to be a morality tale. And he's like, ooh, guns. You know, because that's, if you're going to have one, you know, the last one was about animal testing. This one really loves its gunplay.
Well, last one notwithstanding, a lot of these movies have been about guns and the morality behind them.
Well, but I mean, you got nuclear weapons, you got slavery, you got capital punishment, abortion. I mean, everyone has almost got a specific, that yes, guns and weapons is a part of it. But this, if you're going to have one through the, you know, the last one was animal testing. Like, this one seems to be bring back the weapons and war.
Dreyfuss tells them they're just apes, they don't know any better, so he blows himself up. And I don't know what it is about Gary Oldman, if he signs on movies based on whether or not he blows shit up. Because this, The Professional, Dark Knight Rises.
Well, The Professional, he was coked out that entire time,
that's
too.
That's so true as well. We get our Pride Rock rematch with Caesar and Koba. Yeah, this is very, it's kind of like Simba coming back and fighting Scar. Except they're on the top of the Nakatomi Tower.
I like this fight, though. I think this fight is awesome. I didn't even think about the fact that it was CGI. And, yeah, you're right, Matt. It feels like the top of the Nakatomi Plaza. But I enjoy seeing these two go at it. This is what they've been building to this entire movie. This whole third act, boys, is just, I am so glued to my seat. And I've been waiting for these two to go at it. And when they do, it doesn't disappoint me. I'm into it.
You care at this point because, yeah, we've taken a while to get here. Should I have done with a little more of some apes, you know, wanting to pick a side and all that? Sure. But even that they explain off with just society just goes with whoever's strongest. There's some really good work here. The effects are just superb. And, yeah, the battle is, it's something to behold. You know, they go about it. It's not the same type of fighty scene we've seen a lot. They do some different stuff with it, and I appreciate it. It looks fantastic. Though I will say, and it's one part that bugs me, is because you mentioned that explosion. That explosion goes off at night, and the building comes down in the day. 10 seconds later.
I knew somebody was going to mention that. If it wasn't him, it was going to be me. But this movie also does the Batman Begins thing of, I won't kill you, but I don't have to save you, because he lets Koba fall.
Yep. I couldn't not think that, especially with Gary Oldman in it and everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's him saying, ape will not kill ape, so I technically didn't do it. But it's
and that
it works.
And even that rationale that he's just like, you know, you've betrayed it, you're no longer an ape. You know, he's holding true to the values in some distorted Batman type of I don't kill way.
What's that whole thing of, yeah, you that's know, what... they all watched him kill another ape, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say, too, is at this point, you know, he's not looked at as being a part of the ape society anymore. This is something that Koba holds against him. But Caesar is here to say, look, you can be an ape and also be on their side as well. And yeah, I enjoy this moment a lot, actually. And you know what? I didn't even think about Batman Begins at this point. I was truly into this, boys. I enjoy the way this ends.
So all is not well because the conflict has only just begun. As Malcolm tells Caesar, there is, if you believe Dreyfuss, there is military opposition coming. And he believes that, you know, the humans are not going to roll over nicely, especially given the apes stormed the building. So Caesar tells them, you know, get out before it gets worse. And he tells all the apes, you know, apes together strong, and we prepare for what's to come, because this movie doesn't really end on a cliffhanger, but it does have that middle chapter type of ending where it's leading up to something in the final movie.
It does, but at the same time, we have, I guess you'd call it the Lion King scene, right? Where he's kind of appointed. But to me, that feels complete to me. We have seen a real evolution of this character, and this is another thing we've been leading to, you know, since that first film, since Rise, is this scene of him, and I love it, where all these apes are just, we're having a pan out shot of them, and we're seeing the appointment of Caesar as their leader. And this brought chills to me, I've got to say.
Have a problem with it just because it feels incomplete for one movie, and I don't like that when it exists just to be a sequel. Caesar might as well have just stood there with Malcolm and said, "Be gone? these ape wars have. I mean, it's just, you know exactly where we're going, and it's, yes, it's the beginning of the war, but it is so obvious that it's just here to say, hey, guess what? We have another one coming, and we're going to fight.
So I tend to lean more on Garrett's side that I felt like I got a full story, though, so I don't have that complaint that I do with a lot of second parts of a trilogy.
It could be because I know there's a sequel, and I know and even knowing what the title of that sequel is, it's not fair, maybe, of me to bring that, but when I know that the next one is called War for Planet of the Apes.
And for the record, we should reiterate, this movie should have been called Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and the last one should have been called Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
Yep.
That does it for our lively discussion on Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. So let's answer the question, does this live up to the hype for both of you, since I've seen this movie before? Adam, on a scale of 1 to 10, what do you give Dawn of the Planet of the Apes?
One of the worst things that happened for me going into this film is, for some reason, I saw a discussion of the best sequels in movie history. And literally like an hour before I started watching this, and it was like, rank the best sequels. And somebody ranked this as not one of the better ape sequels, but one of the best sequels of all time, ranking it right behind Aliens and Empire Strikes Back. To that, I got to say, calm your simian tits, everybody. I mean, this is a damn good movie, and it's a damn impressive movie. I think the time between the two and the disconnect with having, you know, an entirely new group of human characters, I think it hurts it a little bit, because the continuity lies solely with Caesar and Koba and Maurice, really. What's the other? Lisa, you know, his wife, but, you know, she's basically given the Natalie Portman thing to do of laying in bed the whole time. The effects work on this are such a step up from the first one, and Rise was really, really good. But to have the amount of apes they do, to bring the emotion out that Weta brings from Andy Serkis's performance and the other apes' performances, sorry, I didn't have everybody's name, is truly superb. The story is hit and miss. There's parts where it is done really well and it's captivating, and there's times where it feels rote and by the numbers and stuff we've seen a lot of times before. But man, this movie, once you get past the first like 30, 40 minutes, gets even more engaging. And I don't even want to say that the buildup is worth it, because the buildup isn't that good. I mean, it's just not. But it really kicks into high gear when it gets going. The look of the city being a post-apocalyptic taken over looks really well. I got a cameo from my place of work in a place that it doesn't exist, but it's nice to see that that's not what San Francisco subways look like whatsoever. But it made me laugh to see everybody who's in this that I care about, which is Andy Serkis, Kerry Russell, and Gary Oldman. They're on point, and I like seeing them on screen. Jason Clarke is a wet blanket through the film, and so are some of the other humans. But this is good. It's really good. I like it better than Rise. I don't know if I'm going to call it my favorite in the entire series, though, but I'm really curious to see where War goes. I do know that I've seen the trailer for that one, and I know who's in that. And I kind of had the same issue, though. When you're resetting humans every film, does any of the human stakes matter? Does this end up being a Godzilla film? But Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, very good sequel, just a little too long and could have been simplified a little bit. But being that I gave the last one a 7, and I got to say that this is a better film, I'm going to give it an 8. Damn good film. I just think that it's nowhere near the best sequel of all time list that people put it on, but it's a damn good sequel.
Got to get one last fucking damn pun in, didn't you?
You know what? That was completely unintentional, so I'm blaming you for catching that. Damn it.
All right. 8 out of 10. Garrett, are you in the same damn?
You know, I gotta say, I've been on the other side of this conversation, and I've been more quiet than usual throughout the course of this, because the majority of the time I've been listening to you guys go back and forth about it, and I just want to ask, other than that, how was the play, Mrs. Lincoln? It's not as bad as you guys made it out to be, even though Adam ended up giving it an 8. That surprises the hell out of me. Look, this movie had so much hype behind it, and as I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, it was the one I was looking forward to watching the most. I will agree with Adam on this much. It does take a little while to get going, and after that initial set of effects I've mentioned 3 or 4 times now, it corrects itself, it rights the ship, and I saw that the people were not the point of this movie. It was about the interactions and how we get to next week's movie, which is War of the Planet of the Apes. This is Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. I think there's something going on there, and Reeves is trying to say something. I think Reeves has something to prove, just as much as Caesar has something to prove throughout the course of this movie, and I think they both rise to that occasion. And I think after you get to that battle, it's a little tough getting there, but after you get to that battle that we mentioned, the big fight in the middle of this movie, or maybe a little past the middle of this movie, it's like a sore dick, guys. It's tough to beat. This movie, it's really, really good once it gets past that. And the last third of this movie is so well written, so well drawn out, that I kind of wish the rest of it was kind of like that. But at the same time, it concludes on a very good note. The performances are not what this movie's about, unless you're talking about the top billed actor, who is Andy Serkis. So, in a lot of ways, Kerry Russell, Jason Clarke, and hell, even Gary Oldman to some point, are kind of like the slasher sequel people, where they don't really matter. We're talking about the apes, and it all came down to Caesar versus Koba. This wasn't about Caesar versus Jason Clarke. And to that extent, and Adam, I gotta go with you too, where I did really laugh when we saw the shot of Bart. It really got a chuckle out of me, considering where you are now. But you know what? To me, after that battle, this lived up to every bit of hype that I expected. It's a really phenomenal movie, and it set me off to actually, again, really look forward to next week's film. And so will it carry over to Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes? Well, that's to be determined. But up to this point, I really respect what Reeves has done with this material, much like I respected what he did with Let Me In. So on that extent, this is an 8.5 out of 10 for me. I had a really good time watching this. I'm glad I finally caught up to it. And I had some distance behind it, because I think with some distance and me being able to watch this with a coy eye, and not just thinking about how I'm going to review it, but how much I enjoy it, is really an experience that I love doing as a podcaster. So, yeah, 8.5 out of 10 for me on Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
Great. I have to be in Garrett's spot that he's so often accused of being in. I think this movie's overrated. I'll be that guy. I'll put that out there right now. I think this movie's fine. It's on par with the previous movie, but I can't give it a higher score. At the end of the day, yes, the humans serve a plot function more than they do characterization. But I still think, even as it is, underwritten and underdelivers. I equate this movie to when I go out to dinner, and I have a really good salad and bread to start, and they send me a nice piece of apple pie a la mode, and they give me a steak that's rare in the middle. I'm like, yeah, it's good, I can eat it, but it pales in comparison to the other two parts that I think are really strong and give me a good case of being satisfied as I leave the restaurant. I think that, like I said, the first one, for its faults, and we mentioned those, has that really strong human connection that complements the ape story that we're seeing. Look, this is the inverse. I don't have a human connection outside of just functionality, and the ape stuff is so good that, yeah, it does lean the scales more on the side of positivity, but I do think there could have been something more with the humans, or not include them at all. Have them be as minimal as possible if you were going to go to this extent to making them as half-baked as they are. I do think this is a good movie, but I am never going to be someone who puts this in the category of best sequels. Especially, a couple months before this, I saw Captain America the Winter Soldier and X-Men Days of Future Past. Both of those I put in much higher esteem than I do this movie. So maybe it's just my expectations, but also, you know, I do have to compare things to what I had seen that summer. And going back to this for the first time in a long time, my thoughts are the same. The ape stuff is wonderful. It's got a really strong opening and a fantastic third act that gives me everything I want as far as being entertained on a visual level while still having something to say. But the middle of this movie, when it's not focused on Caesar and Koba, I'm checking my watch. So I'm giving this a 7, but I like the first one more. I'll say that up front. That creates an interesting perspective going into the third movie, War for the Planet of the Apes. I have seen this one, as I've seen all of them, and I definitely have my thoughts saved up. So, Adam, now that you've seen this one, what are you thinking going into War?
I got a bad feeling that it's going to be overly long, and I think the issues I had with this film are going to be a little more prevalent. I based it on absolutely nothing other than seeing Woody Harrelson shave his head. Look, the humans aren't what we're here for. And if we're going to have them, it needs to be compelling like we got in Rise and not really anywhere else. So I'm excited to see it because I want to know how it fits in this trilogy, soon to be quadrilogy and more. But I don't feel like it's going to be a finale just because now I know that we have Kingdom coming, which means, guess what? We know who survives and who doesn't, so it takes some of that out of the realm. But I'm excited to see it. I mean, the trailer, the apes look phenomenal. Matt Reeves back again, so I'm willing to see what goes on. But this is another one I haven't seen, so it'll be, you know, big screen at home, soundbar on, and we'll see if this war brings me some peace to the series.
Garrett, same sentiments?
I have no idea, because unlike this movie, I haven't heard a thing about War of the Planet of the Apes. So going in, I have zero background on it, and I'm not going to watch a trailer going into it. I'm going to go in very, very, very cold. This is as cold as I've gone into any viewing for this podcast. The only thing I know about it is that Woody Harrelson is in it. That is literally the only thing. And, of course, Caesar as well.
Yeah, there's some
Andy Serkis. Yeah, there's some apes. Other than that, like, I'm going in, this is so cold that I might as well be in a winter storm. I have no idea what to expect.
I got to shut up then, because I have my thoughts, and I can't say a fucking thing. Because I can't show my hand at all, and I can't tease what the next movie is. I do know it'll make for a good conversation, as these all have. Boys, we're almost done. We got two more movies to go, and hopefully Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes warrants as promising of a discussion as we've had for basically all of these eight movies. But we got one more to go in between, so we're going to close out this trilogy next week. So until next week, when we do War for the Planet of the Apes, we've been through hell together. We spent 4 years fighting that podcast and another 4 years fighting each other. Thank you, guys.
Let me make a last appeal to your reason before we inflict more of this on you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Three Men in a Retrospective Podcast.
Thank you.
Join us next week for an entirely new review.
Tell me something, McDonald. Can we make the future what we wish?
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Aldo was right. War has come.
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
So many questions I want to ask.
And if you enjoyed this review, please head on over to percolatedmedia.net or search your podcast platform of choice to access our Percolated Media archives and hear our reviews of other franchises like Star Wars, Indiana Jones, Pirates of the Caribbean, the films adapted from the published works of Stephen King, Top Gun, the DC Universe featuring Batman, the Superman DC Universe, and so many more.
And so, Mandemus, we must be patient and wait.
The Three Men in a Retrospective Podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
Do they look like just apes to you?
Given the power to alter the future, have we the right to use it?
The Three Men in a Retrospective Podcast is edited by Garrett.
I'll abide by that finding.
Just hear what I have to say.
The Three Men in a Retrospective Podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
You just imagine that he hurt you.
For the moment, we should follow their example.
The Three Men in a Retrospective Podcast is for review and discussion, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
In one of the countless billions of galaxies in the universe lies a medium-sized star, and one of its satellites, a green and insignificant planet, is now dead.
Shuma.
He
you should have had Gary Oldman and Jason Clarke switch roles.
There you go. Yeah, there's an idea.
He looks like he just finished his speech in The Dark Knight Rises and walked right across the soundstage.
Yeah. Got a megaphone again. Well, I'll give him this. This character is a lot more forthcoming about his intentions than Gordon in Dark Knight Rises, where he basically says, yeah, lying is okay as long as you get away with it.
That's a directed by N.L. Ross.
Yeah, and that's a revisit that argument. But Caesar walks...
He was Commissioner Gordon, you know, to everybody. We can't let him be the focus of this film.
I'm pretty sure this is like the fifth franchise we've done with Gary Oldman. Let's see, this, Hannibal, Harry Potter, Dark Knight, RoboCop. That's five.
That's five.
He's got to be our biggest, he's probably our biggest recurring person
give out awards.
Actually, Oppenheimer makes six.
Now let's get that Fifth Element sequel.
Oh, for God's sake.
Yeah, he would not be the professional on that set. Be like, why did you ask me to come back? But he's... So until next time, when we do War for the Planet of the Apes... I'm going to say that again. I was about to cough. So until next week, when we do War for the Planet of the Apes... Ha 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 ha